In this module, I'm going to be talking about the disorders of behaviour and personality that occur following a brain injury. This is probably one of the most important areas of psychological or psychiatric injury as far as brain injury is concerned. And the majority of time of therapists is often spent looking at the disorders of behaviour and personality. While in the other modules we've talked about recognised psychiatric disease, in this situation, the disorders of behaviour and personality are far more difficult to define and are subject to a great deal of controversy. In this module, what I'm going to do is actually define what I mean by behaviour and personality, and then follow very much the sequence of all the other modules in terms of looking at the epidemiology of the disorder, whether there is any particular regional specialisation of the brain that allows us to get a better understanding about personality and behaviour, and then talk about the management of what is a very difficult area in traumatic brain injury. Now, behaviour is an action or a pattern of activity in an individual, and it's something that can be measured. For most people, the behaviour is often predictive and quite stereotypic for that individual person. What's very important is that behaviour generally has internal and external triggers. And in the area of analysis of disorders of behaviour, it's always important to remember that there can be internal triggers that are not immediately obvious that lead to the behaviour that is the cause of investigation or study. Personality is an area that many psychiatrists are very familiar with and other health professionals will have some understanding of. It is probably the most controversial area in psychiatry in terms of the definition or defining of what is personality, and then going on to look at what are personality disorders. Personality is defined as an enduring pattern of thinking, perceiving and relating to the environment and oneself. And one of the characteristics about personality is that we can see it both within a personal context and within a social context. When a person's personality characteristics or traits become flexible, maladaptive and rigid, then we consider them to have a personality disorder. There will be some branches of medicine that choose not to recognise the concept of personality disorders because they see it as pejorative labelling. And there's no doubt that in medicine, people who are labelled as having a personality disorder often elicit a very particular response from those people that are caring for them. So the application of the term personality disorder should be used very carefully and should be kept within the context of attempting to communicate in a succinct manner aspects of the person and how they might relate or react in a particular situation. An important component of personality disorder is that the traits, which are rigid and inflexible, have to cause distress to the person or to their environment. Interestingly enough, personality disorders in general psychiatry often cause a great deal of distress to the individual. One of the big changes that you see in traumatic brain injury is that the personality characteristics often don't cause distress to the individual, but are more often reported as causing stress to those people within their environment, or causing disruptions for the person in their ability to relate to their environment. Personality disorder is in modern societies typically defined according to ICD-10 or to the DSM-4. There is probably a preference for using the DSM-4 criteria for personality disorder because it lists very clearly the key characteristics or components of the individual personality disorders, and it's a very good way of communicating what one can expect from an individual in certain situations. In the latter part of this presentation, I'll be talking about some of the personality disorders that are seen following brain injury, and I'll be using the DSM-4 criteria to define or to characterise those disorders. Again, as in other modules, I direct the listener to this presentation to actually look at the DSM-4 so that you have a fairly good understanding of the types of conditions or disorders that I'm about to speak about. There are some general comments that we should make about personality disorders in psychiatry in general. Personality disorders are that group of patients that often elicit, as I said before, a very particular response in health professionals. The incidence of personality disorders is going to vary substantially according to which clinical setting the measurement of personality is made. So, for example, if we look at inpatient settings, outpatient clinical populations, you'll get a fairly high incidence of personality disorders. Probably between 15 to 25% of those populations could be defined as having a clear personality disorder. In the clinical populations, you'll also often see a clustering of personality traits, but the person doesn't reach the threshold for actually having a personality disorder. In community settings, the incidence of personality disorder is lower. As we've seen in a lot of the other conditions, when looking at community samples, the incidence of all psychiatric illness is generally lower than you would see in a clinical population. For personality disorders, about 3% of the population will have a personality disorder as defined by DSM-4. The measurement or the determination of personality disorder is now typically done using the instrument called the Schedule for the Clinical Interview for DSM-4, and it's a special interview particularly only focusing on personality, and it can make an assessment of personality or personality disorder in the time frame when you're seeing the person, but over the lifetime of that individual as well. I'm going to talk about some studies looking at personality and personality disorder in brain injury, and the SID-2 is what is being used in these studies and case samples of personality. There are, however, a number of other ways that we can measure or assess personality. There are projective tests, there are structured personality tests, and personality trait inventories that can be used. And I'll list some of those as we go on. One of the important things about personality disorders is that they frequently complicate the management of that individual, and that they actually, in fact, alter the outcome of the person as far as what happens to them when they're in a setting. So if you've got a personality disorder and a major mental illness, your outcome will often be less than that predicted in a population sample where there isn't, in fact, a disorder of personality. One of the things I haven't mentioned is that you can have an Axis 1, that is a major mental illness, diagnosis, as well as a personality disorder at the same time. And the DSM-4 in particular allows to have multiple axes and multiple diagnoses. And people can have more than one type of personality disorder, because you've got to remember that the personality disorder classifications are quite restricted, and so someone may have key characteristics or components of more than one disorder evident when you are seeing them. We know that people with personality disorder actually cause an increased amount of burden to those people in their environment or in their community. And this is something I want you to remember when we're talking about personality changes in brain injury, because in the general population where there isn't physical or cognitive impairments, having a personality disorder is going to increase the burden of care. So it's highly likely that this situation is going to occur when someone has a traumatic brain injury. The other thing that we know is that people with personality disorder find it harder to cope with stress, and their maladaptive personality traits, the inflexibility of it, mean that when a stress occurs, they react in a very predictable manner, and often that predictable manner is, as is defined in the condition, maladaptive and causes quite substantial stress for the individual. Now, one of the things that I have focused on throughout the entire presentation is looking at the regional specialisation of the brain and how that may help us to understand personality and personality change following brain injury. Now, there are two key areas that are very important as far as the regional specialisation of the brain for personality. We don't have a nice, neat area in the brain that helps us to say, well, this is the area of the brain responsible for personality, as we do, for example, for speech or motor activity or for some of the other more complex cognitive functions. What we can say that if people damage in particular their frontal region of the brain or their limbic or the areas involved in the limbic system, that often change in personality is quite evident. Now, the limbic system is actually very important for emotion. And one of the key things you need to remember is that disorders of behaviour are often due to difficulties with regards to regulating emotion. And the limbic system is really important for helping us to experience basic emotions. It also helps to regulate the intensity and the stability of those emotional experiences. Finally, the limbic system is very important for the control of emotions in an individual. So it becomes very obvious then that if you damage the limbic system, and we need to remember that the limbic system is a circuit or a series of neuronal networks within the brain. It's not one particular area. It's going to encompass frontal regions or prefrontal cortex, as well as areas of the temporal lobe and very basic primitive structures of the brain that I've previously outlined in the first presentation. So the limbic area is in fact very vulnerable for damage in head injury because it is a very wide area throughout the brain, and there are lots of opportunities for disrupting it. So disruption to the limbic system often results in disturbances of behaviour and changes in personality. The other really important area is the cortical or executive regions of the brain. And in particular in the basal ganglia, we're looking at the caudate nucleus, which is in itself a very small structure but very densely packed with neuronal circuits and interconnections between various regions of the brain. And the frontal regions of the brain, as we know, are important for things such as the planning and organising of behaviour, problem solving, decision making, abstraction and integration of information, and also for awareness. So if a person damages the frontal regions of their brain, or the caudate area or the basal ganglia, which serves as an important relay network, then often you can see changes in behaviour that might ultimately lead to the diagnosis of a personality disorder. As I've mentioned in all presentations, the frontal areas are particularly vulnerable to damage following head injury, simply due to the nature of the anatomy of the brain within the hard case of the skull. I mentioned earlier on that I'm going to talk about personality disorders according to the DSM-IV criteria. And the reason I'm choosing to do this is that the criteria have been fairly well established, and most community populations and clinical groups will have a good understanding or have accessibility to the DSM-IV. One of the problems with personality and personality disorder is that each theoretician is going to have a different system for personality. And this also holds true not only in general psychiatry, but in fact in traumatic brain injury. And some of the key workers who have looked at behaviour and personality in traumatic brain injury have proposed their own theories or models of personality and personality change. Prigatano and Lezak have both proposed their own individual diagnostic systems with regards to personality. There, of course, have always been the very traditional descriptions of personality change following brain injury, the pseudo-depressive and the pseudo-sociopathic population. Now, the concept of pseudo-depressive and pseudo-psychopathic personality is one that's incredibly well entrenched in medicine, and particularly in the areas of neurology and neurosurgery. Unfortunately, these branches of medicine really haven't moved on to understand that the changes in personality following brain injury are far broader. So you'll still see reports from specialists, in particular often the neurologists and neurosurgeons, who describe people as having the pseudo-depressive or the pseudo-sociopathic personality. The pseudo-depressive is the sort of like withdrawn, amotivated, adynamic individual, and the pseudo-sociopathic is the disinhibited, rule-breaking person. And as we all know in clinical practice, using two terms to define personality or to describe personality change is far more restrictive than is reasonable when considering a realistic and clinical population. And it's also very narrow. I mean, people with a traumatic brain injury have such diverse changes of behaviour and personality, to think that we could use two terms probably is a reflection of a lack of understanding of brain function and anatomy and the complexity of the brain. Prigatano proposes four models, and they're four types of personality, and they're quite broad in the description. They include things such as a depressive type of personality, an amotivated type of personality, the disinhibited. And Lezak has five key areas of dysfunction that she talks about and really focuses on social function and social interaction. There are, of course, various clinical scales or schedules that are used to define personality, and these are also quite commonly used by psychologists to describe personality, and the MMPI is the most well-known descriptor of personality. The poor soul has to complete about 520 questions, and from that a person derives an understanding of personality. But there is also the MCMI, which is the million classification system, and the SCL, which will also provide you some understanding of personality. Almost certainly these three clinical schedules that are used, you can see them quite commonly still being used by psychologists for the description of personality. And finally, of course, we have DSM-IV and ICD-10. The importance about the DSM-IV classification is that we're really using a very structured clinical interview to determine personality. And sometimes in a clinical interview, you can get a lot more information than you might be able to get from a person answering a series of questions. The other thing that I've often found, particularly with my brain injured patients, is that when they've been asked to do the MMPI, by the time they're at about question 250, they're quite tired. So they just flick off answers, really not paying a great deal of attention to what they're answering. So how valid that can be in a clinical population is also something that we need to consider. So how common is a change in personality following a brain injury? Well, it really depends on what paper you're looking at, who's done the investigation, and which patient population is being examined. And the issues that I've raised in all other areas of these series of presentations about who is going to be doing the investigation, which patient population is being chosen, which method is being used, really applies here more so than in any other area. Clearly, if we're going to assess personality by using a rating scale, we're going to get a different result as if we're using a structured interview. And if you're going to use projective tests, you're going to get a further different result in comparison to the other study methods that can be used. So the incidence of personality change is a really complex area, and there really are no good studies available over time that clearly identify change in personality, apart from the two that I'm going to focus on in this presentation. And the reason I've chosen to focus on them is because, in fact, they are very good scientific studies and give us a much better understanding about personality after brain injury. There are innumerable studies looking at changes of behaviour, and I'm sure everyone who works in the area of brain injury is going to be familiar with the work of Brooks and his research group, clearly documenting behaviour and the common behaviour changes over time, and then progressing on and seeing what changes in behaviour, how they were influenced by time in terms of which behaviours became more of a problem as time progressed. And a lot of the work we now do in looking at behaviour and understanding behaviour change, particularly in those people who've had long-term brain injury, has really been influenced by the work of Brooks and his research group. As I mentioned very early on, there's quite a lot of controversy about personality, and I think some of the reasons we don't have a lot of studies about personality is the fact that many people in the community see that the labelling of a person with personality or personality disorder can be somewhat pejorative and also isolating for that individual. In terms of the studies that are available, the study by Hibbard of 2000 and the study by Component of 2002 are the key studies that I'd like you to look at, and the references for these will be available at the end of the presentation. The SID-4, which is in fact based on the DSM-4 personality disorder tool, was used by Hibbard to make an assessment of personality. Now, Hibbard also did an assessment of Axis 1 diagnosis, and that paper is also available and referred to on the CD-ROMs for you to look at. And I really recommend looking at these papers because the methodology that has been used is, in fact, I think, very good. And they were looking at the severity of personality and personality change within a community population where there was a variety of severity of injury. So Hibbard's study doesn't focus solely on severe traumatic brain injury, but also has mild traumatic brain injury. There is a slight skewing of the patient population to the more severe sample, and in many ways that's understandable because, as I've previously referred to, the more severe the brain injury, the more likely we're to see changes in behaviour and emotional control. So the Hibbard population, about 50% had a more significant head injury. One of the things that Hibbard found was that 24% of the population, in fact, had a personality disorder as defined by DSM-4 prior to their brain injury. The antisocial and obsessive compulsive personalities were the more common variants found pre-injury. And the author suggested that this wasn't necessarily that surprising, particularly with regards to the antisocial personality disorders, that they may engage in behaviours that increase their risk for sustaining a brain injury. What Hibbard found was that 66% of people who had a traumatic brain injury had a diagnosis of a personality disorder after their brain injury. Now, that's an incredibly high incidence of personality disorder. And Hibbard proposed, in fact, that it was important to be aware of the high incidence of the abnormality of personality following brain injury, and went on to suggest a number of strategies and techniques that need to be incorporated in rehabilitation units because of this really incredibly high incidence. What he found as far as the types of personality disorder was a very high incidence of borderline personality disorder, and about a third of the sample had a borderline personality disorder according to DSM-4. The other diagnostic groups that were very common were the obsessive compulsive and avoidant. And I'm going to go on to talk a little bit about these personality characteristics because it's really quite illuminating when we look at the neuroanatomy and the functioning of the brain and these personality disorders to see how they might arise and why they might be so common after a traumatic brain injury. The paranoid and antisocial personality disorders were also more common than that found within the community. And the variance of rates between community samples and the samples in traumatic brain injury was substantially higher. So, for example, the incidence of borderline personality disorder or cluster B disorders, including histrionic and narcissistic, is about 5% in the general population. So it's somewhat higher, slightly higher incidence in women. But in this study, 32% was really quite substantially higher than you'd see in a normal population. And that difference between men and women that you often see in general psychiatry wasn't actually evident in this study. So normally you get more of the cluster B or borderline traits evident in women in the community, but in this population the difference between men and women wasn't as great. The other thing that Hibbard found that was quite interesting was that those people who pre-injury had a personality disorder, that they actually got an increased number of personality disorders. So they went from maybe having one type of personality disorder to now having two. So it significantly increased their morbidity associated with their brain injury. So that if we identify people who have a personality disorder prior to the brain injury, when they first arrive in acute rehabilitation settings, that's going to have a lot of value in terms of managing these patients, because we know that they're at a significantly higher risk for getting changes in their personality that are even more dysfunctional after the brain injury. Capone is the other study that is of interest in this area. And the interesting thing about this study is that there's a 30-year follow-up study. So he selected people who had been up to 30 years post-injury and used the SID-3R, which is the SID that's devised for the DSM-3R. There aren't a great deal of changes in the area of personality between 3R and 4, so I think the two studies are actually quite comparable. The study, again, was a long-term follow-up study, which is quite interesting because we know from the work that Brooks did that often the changes in behaviour and personality become more of a problem as time goes on. And also that some of the problems you might get with people failing to recognise their change in personality in the early days, by the time they get to 30 years, they've probably got a much better awareness about how they have changed, so that they may be more accurate in terms of reporting their personality or personality change. Now, Caponin also used the concept of organic personality disorder from ICD-10 in his study, and the reason that I raise this is that there's a great deal of overlap between borderline and organic personality disorder in terms of the criteria. And he again found quite a high incidence of avoidant, paranoid and schizoid personality disorders following brain injury, and also a high number of organic, about 15% had an organic personality disorder. Caponin pointed out that the incidence of personality disorder in his study was higher than that we see in the general population. It was a bit lower than the Hibbard study, and part of that may be influenced by the fact that Hibbard was actually looking at people who had had a brain injury from a rehabilitation setting, although in the Hibbard group they were still 7 years post-brain injury, so they're quite a substantial time post-injury as well. But there was a comparability between the results, but the generalisations that we can make from these two studies is that the incidence of personality change after brain injury is very common, and that the changes in personality often lead the person to have what can be clinically defined as a personality disorder. And as I previously mentioned, personality disorders often cause a lot of problem in management, particularly with regards to the clinical staff. They often elicit very characteristic responses from clinical staff because of the maladaptive traits that they have. So this is clearly a very substantial problem. If we take into account sub-threshold diagnoses or changes in behaviour, then the incidence of change in behaviour is up to 100% depending on which studies we look at. For some of them it's in the range of about, for example, aggressiveness and irritability can be found in up to 80% of people who've had a traumatic brain injury. So we're talking about a really substantial problem within clinical practice. Now, how do we assess people for personality and personality change following brain injury? As with all the other modules, the most important part of the assessment is in fact an interview. The use of a structured clinical interview is probably in this situation recommended because it allows one to then derive at very clear diagnostic categories that have been predetermined by substantial research. The description of such as pseudo-psychopathic or pseudo-depressive were terms that were devised by clinicians and the applicability and the ability to apply that to various people is quite low because different people will have different thresholds. So a structured clinical interview provides one with very clear guidelines in terms of the criteria to make a diagnosis of personality. One of the most important things about the assessment, however, is going to be to actually not only interview the person who's had the traumatic brain injury, but the significant other. And this is because, particularly in the early days, impairment of awareness can impact on the person's ability to report their problems with regards to their behaviour and personality. And because often people are quite embarrassed about aspects of their personality or functioning, they're not going to actually reveal it. So you can often get a lot of information from another party, and it's probably mandatory when we're looking at personality change to make sure we interview the other party. People such as Lezak and Prigatano, in fact, have proposed that it should be mandatory that an assessment of personality with a structured clinical interview be part of any neuropsychometric assessment in a rehabilitation unit. Now, I'm sure any neuropsychologist who's listening to this presentation will cringe at this thought because it's a substantially time-heavy investigation to do. To do a structured interview of someone with personality is going to take you probably about an hour, if not a little bit longer, for someone who's got a brain injury. A neuropsychometric assessment in its own right takes a great deal of time. But particularly Prigatano and Lezak point out that because personality change is so substantial, it's actually very important that we have a good understanding of what the change in personality has been and what the type of problems are going to be. Because there's a certain predictive validity. For example, if someone has a borderline personality disorder, we know that they're going to have substantial emotional instability, and we can probably even predict what situations that might arise. So I think there's a great deal of validity with regards to making it mandatory that we always do an assessment of personality. And the use of a structured clinical interview is something to be looked at. Interestingly enough, we can train non-health professionals to use the SID, so it's not as if it must be done by a psychologist, and maybe that's one of the areas that we need to look at, is training more people to be able to do these clinical interviews. As with all the other assessments and the other modules, it's really important to exclude other factors that might be causing personality change. And one of the most important ones is temporal lobe epilepsy. We know that people with temporal lobe epilepsy have particular personality type of characteristics, or they're more common. But one of the things that you can see with someone with temporal lobe epilepsy is that you can get very substantial changes in behaviour and personality because of an unrecognised seizure activity. So an EEG is mandatory in any person who has an assessment of personality, and in particular if the history is of a recent change. So they might have had their brain injury 2 or 3 years ago, and in the past 6 to 12 months their personality has changed. We also need to exclude things such as hydrocephalus, a raised intracranial pressure, but also other organic conditions such as thyroid intoxication or an overactive thyroid can also cause us changes in personality and behaviour, and these factors do need to be taken into account. You've made the assessment of a person and you've decided that they in fact do have a personality disorder or substantial personality traits that are causing significant problems. How are we going to manage that individual? There are some general principles that cover the management of this area, and I've kept them as general because we could in fact probably make a whole series of presentations looking at various interventions and strategies that we can use in managing people with these very complex and difficult problems. The other problem is that often generalisations fail in this situation in a presentation because each individual patient comes with their unique personality, and so we have to really do an individual assessment and target the management to that individual person. And so these are overall general principles that I'd like people to remember, and as you can probably gather from all the other presentations, assessment is the key first step of management. You can't manage a disturbance of behaviour or personality without having a really good assessment. And that assessment, it comes from the person and significant others. And that assessment often will involve taking quite complex and detailed diaries, looking at what's triggering the person's behaviour disturbance. If you can't see an obvious external trigger, then you might need to look at internal triggers. And in many times, it might actually be a description of the event to the patient and then asking them what they think was going on, or getting family members to actually ask the person immediately after the outburst or erratic behaviour what was happening to that individual. Important things to look at as far as the initial assessment include, you know, the environment where the behaviours occur, what the triggers might be, and sometimes there can be very subtle triggers. For example, fatigue is a very common trigger for aggressive behaviours and irritability that are a key component of that person's personality. So a detailed analysis of what the behaviour is and an assessment of this is extremely important. The next stage in the management of a person with disorders of behaviour is to look at the importance of the organic factors and compare them with other things that might be implicated in the behaviour and maintaining the behaviour. In the area of disorders of behaviour, particularly in young adults, the intoxication or the use of drugs and alcohol are extremely important. If the disturbance of behaviour becomes more of a problem when drug and alcohol use is implicated, then obviously the management also needs to be targeted at the use of the drugs and alcohol. And this will involve, you know, education of the patient, but also often their family members, about the importance of trying to prevent excessive use of drugs and alcohol. Often, as time progresses, the environment, in fact, maintains the disturbance of behaviour. Now, that might seem very strange, but the many cases where I have clinically witnessed as family members, in fact, provoke and aggravate the person's behaviour because they are just so fed up and tired with the situation that they find themselves in. So while it's important to assess the individual, it's also important to have a really good understanding of what environmental factors are going to be going on. You know, the organic factors in terms of what regions of the brain have more predominantly been damaged, the type of cognitive impairments, the type of executive dysfunction are obviously very important in the management, but an understanding of how the family might or the environment might act to provoke or trigger disturbances of behaviour are going to be key. Often management programs for these conditions fail because the environmental factors have not been taken into account. And it's paramount that we take those environmental factors, particularly family members and their behaviour, into account. Now, this is particularly important for people who had a pre-existing personality disorder that may have been made more severe by the brain injury. People with personality disorders, their relationships are often quite dysfunctional in their own right. People with personality disorders often tend to get involved with people who, you know, match their personality. And then, of course, they have their brain injury, and that match doesn't happen anymore. So you can get quite substantial complexities in the relationships. And so it's important to look at who is around the person who's had the brain injury and what they are doing to provoke or precipitate or maintain the disorder. The next important aspect of the management is, in fact, the team who manages the person. Now, this might seem to be incredibly obvious, but as was pointed out by Hibbard in his paper looking at personality disorder, often one of the key components of management is that the team members have a different goal. If we know a person has a significant disturbance of behaviour and a personality disorder, one of the things that people with personality disorders frequently do, in particular those with borderline personality disorders, and we have to remember they are the most common types of personality disorders seen, is that they tend to split team members. So what they do is that they actually, in fact, create an environment where one member of the team is taking sides with the patient and the other member of the team is being pitted against each other, and that environment often causes a lot of conflict within the rehabilitation team itself. So part of the management is going to involve getting all the team together, using a multidisciplinary team, and remembering that the physiotherapist or the occupational therapist who's looking at functional skills is also a really important person as far as dealing with the behaviour and personality change. Every team member must have the same goal, which is a reduction of the disturbance of behaviour. And the reason I emphasise that every team member must have the same goal is that you can see a situation where inadvertently, for example, the psychologist and the social worker are trying to diminish the triggers for the behaviour and to reduce the positive reinforcements for the negative behaviour, and inadvertently the physiotherapist, because they're not aware that the program is going on, is actually reinforcing the aggressive behaviours. So getting the team together and making sure that every team member has the same goal is extremely important. The other thing that's very important is that the management strategies need to be written down so that each team member has a clear guideline of how they are supposed to respond on each occasion with the behaviour. We know that for people with traumatic brain injury who have learning problems, that if we present the same challenge consistently over time, they have a greater chance of actually learning the new material in a way that is effective and beneficial for them. And this also holds true when we're looking at managing their behaviours. The fourth component of management is to, in fact, look at rational pharmacotherapy. Now, most members of the audience will be very aware of the fact that pharmacotherapy is not something that's frequently thought of as far as personality disorders is concerned. But in the case where the personality disorder has been caused by organic factors, there is some validity in looking at the rational use of pharmacotherapy. I emphasise the term rational because some pharmacological agents reduce the person's ability to learn, can cause neurological side effects, and it would seem to be of little value to be managing the behaviour but then actually retarding the person's recovery and rehabilitation. Some of the drugs that have been shown to be effective in diminishing some aspects of the personality, particularly to do when we look at things like, for example, anxiety, aggressiveness, and irritability, we know that the anticonvulsants can be very good for managing the agitation and aggressiveness and irritability that you can see after brain injury. Antidepressants, in particular the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors that I've previously referred to, can in fact be very good for the management of aggressiveness and irritability that isn't an antidepressant effect. And you know that it's not an antidepressant effect because the family members can see the change in irritability and aggressiveness within a day or two of them taking the medication. And it seems to be that serotonin is implicated in aggressiveness and irritability. Some people will use antipsychotics for those individuals with personality disorders. We have to be very cautious about the use of particularly the old-fashioned or typical neuroleptics because they can retard recovery of brain function and also because of the high risk of neurological side effects. In Australia, the prescription of atypical neuroleptics for people with personality disorder involves the writing of a private prescription. You can't do it on the PBS because the person doesn't have schizophrenia. And so that then can mean quite a substantial cost. I think also the role in terms of using antipsychotics in the management of behaviour and personality should really be a peripheral role rather than the, you know, the first drug of choice or the first treatment that is used. One of the areas that is not greatly explored in Australia, but almost certainly I know has been looked at in great detail, particularly in Scandinavian countries and now also in the United States, is the use of what I call cognitive enhancers for the management of behaviour. If we look at the drugs that are used to now treat dementia, and I sort of like use the term treat dementia in inverted commas because, of course, we don't actually treat the underlying dementia. We prevent the deterioration or the emergence of symptoms associated with the dementia. We have a series of drugs now that we can use in dementia populations. And if you actually analyse the results of the studies that have been put forward by the pharmaceutical companies for their dementia drugs, often you see quite a substantial reduction in abnormalities of behaviour with these medications. And the theory is that because of better attention and better memory and learning, that you don't get the same disturbances of behaviour. Now, in Scandinavian countries, there have been a number of very large studies looking at these cognitive enhancers or dementia drugs in people with traumatic brain injury. A lot of the studies have focused on memory and learning and outcome, and we know that if you try and measure improvements in memory and learning with the dementia drugs, that the results are often not of statistical significance in head injured populations. But if you measure behaviour change with the use of these drugs, you actually see quite a substantial improvement. So I think this is going to be an area of increased research over the years in terms of looking at changes of behaviour and personality and the use of the dementia drugs. Finally, one can sometimes use stimulants for the management of personality change, and the role of the stimulants is, in fact, that if a person has a disturbance of behaviour with impulsivity or difficulties with motivation because of reduced attention, the stimulants in fact improve the sustained attention of that person. So the very judicious and careful choice of stimulants can have some role to play in the pharmacological management of personality. I really would, however, like to emphasise that the use of pharmacological agents should really be if other therapeutic strategies have failed and with very clear goals in mind. It's important not to use multiple agents. You'll see on the list that I've avoided listing the benzodiazepines because they often exaggerate behaviour disturbances rather than improve them. And that when we're using pharmacological agents, we have to have very clear goals in mind as to why we're using them, and if they haven't been of any value, to then withdraw the drug. Sometimes what you can see is that medications are added on top of medications, and we're actually causing problems in this situation rather than improving them. In the management, I've alluded to the fact in the early stages that we've got to assess what non-organic factors or environmental factors are involved in provoking the behaviours or maintaining the behaviours and abnormalities of personality. And so it then becomes very important that one of those key environmental factors, which is the family, is actually co-opted in the treatment of the individual. The family have to be involved in the treatment in the assessment process, but also in the planning of the treatment and the administration of the treatment. Because most therapists will spend 1 or 2 hours a week at most with the patient. The family members will spend the 166 hours of the week that are left. So they're going to be the key administrators of any kind of therapy or management that is being offered to a person with a disturbance of behaviour. And so they have to be involved with it. They have to know what it's about. They have to be able to follow the plan in a rational way. And often you can see some resistances to changing family members in these situations, and that might be because of pre-existing personality abnormalities, but it also can be because they just simply don't understand it, or that they find the consequences of following the plan too difficult. For example, it's well and good for a therapist to say, well, you just don't give in when John wants to go out. The family member might find that John's response to that, which is to hit them, isn't acceptable, so they're not going to follow through the management plan. So we have to make sure that the families are actually happy to pursue that management plan, and therefore they've actually got to be involved in the treatment and planning part of it. The management will really focus on looking at behavioural approaches for the disinhibited behaviours, and interestingly enough, the majority of the authors have actually in fact proposed an inpatient setting be used for a lot of the behaviour disorders. Now I'm sure many of you as you listen to this are thinking, which inpatient unit? And that's right, we don't have an appropriate facility available to us to manage people with these disorders in the United States and in the United Kingdom, particularly with the work of Eames and Wood. There are a number of very well established behavioural units for people with behavioural disturbances following traumatic brain injury, where the people are admitted for 9 to 18 months and a very rigid behaviour program is put in place where we try and maximise the positive behaviours and extinguish the undesirable behaviours. And these programs have in fact been shown to be very successful and effective, but they're costly. It's often difficult to find the right staff to run such a unit. There aren't many people who have the training to be able to provide the appropriate care in these settings. And of course, in Australia, we don't actually have the infrastructure to allow us to do this. So any management, particularly of the disinhibited, more externalising behaviours, are going to be quite a challenge within our community currently. As I mentioned earlier, I'm actually going to go through some of the types of personalities that you can see following a brain injury, and these are the commonest types that have been identified by Hibbard. And the reason I want to do this is because they occur commonly, they might provide you with some informational clues as to how to manage your patients, because invariably it's the patients with the personality disorder that are the most difficult to manage in a patient population and are often what we call our heart sink patients, because they are so resistant to change, or change doesn't seem to be as easy to elicit or initiate in that individual. With the patient with the obsessive compulsive disorder, the key component is that they're preoccupied with order, they like things to be perfect, and they need to have a sense of control on their environment. And this is often at the expense of being flexible and efficient. Now, as you listen to this description of an obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, you probably can identify a large number of patients with traumatic brain injury who will have these components of their behaviour. And rightly so, you're probably saying, well, yes, that's because of the damage to their frontal regions of the brain, and often also to the caudate area of the brain as well, because the basal ganglia, in particular the caudate nucleus, is really important for establishment of patterns of behaviour, so that if you disrupt or damage that area, you can get the abnormal entrenchment of behaviour. And we know that damage to the caudate nucleus is also really important for perseveration. And many components of an obsessive-compulsive personality disorder has a feature of perseveration to it. We know that people with brain injury will often establish patterns and rituals to try and compensate for their memory and executive impairments. And so the obsessive-compulsive personality disorder is often, in fact, an adaptation to the changes that have occurred to that person following a traumatic brain injury. And they're doing it to try and maximise their functioning. But of course, what happens is that the inflexibility means that their environment becomes more and more restricted, and they can't cope with any kind of change in their environment. And our modern world is about change. And so they often cause a lot of distress to the individual, or in particular to their family. One of the things that needs to happen when we manage a person with an obsessive-compulsive personality disorder is that obviously we need to use the normal cognitive rehabilitation strategies, you know, the utilisation of diaries and list-making, etc. But what you actually have to do is actually dampen it down a little bit so that the person isn't excessively checking, because that's what their obsessive personality is going to lead them to do. I have a number of patients in my practice who have obsessive compulsive personality disorder, and what we actually do is we recognise that they need to check because they are forgetful, but we in fact put a routine in for the checking where we get them to use a checklist. And once they've checked and they've checked off the list, they then are in fact taught a cognitive strategy where they actually have to remind themselves that they have already checked, they've got the checklist to prove it, and they're not allowed to go back and check again. So what you actually do is you utilise their positive aspect of their personality, their need for order and lists, but you limit it so it doesn't become dysfunctional. And that establishment of the behavioural contract is extremely important for people who have the obsessive-compulsive disorder. The other thing that's really important is to educate the family members that the obsessive-compulsive personality disorder is that individual's method of compensating for their brain injury, so that rather than becoming angry and frustrated, helping them to look at novel ways that we can limit the extent of the behaviour by utilising the behavioural contracts. The avoidant personality disorder is in fact a person who is very socially disinhibited. They often feel very inadequate, and they're quite sensitive to criticism. They avoid social interaction because of their perceived sense of failure. And often the avoidant personality disorder is one that emerges over time. And almost certainly we think that what's very important in the genesis of this personality disorder is the language impairments that can occur very commonly in people who have had a brain injury, and also the difficulties they have with, for example, social perception, recognising appropriate social cues. And they deal with that by becoming very withdrawn and failing to interact, and they avoid interaction because of their perceived sense that they are inadequate. It's often seen, particularly in left frontal injuries, and more likely you'll see it in a person who, prior to the injury, while they may not have had an avoidant personality disorder, they weren't particularly confident about their functioning and capabilities previously, and that they really relied on their linguistic skills and their social skills to be able to cope in society. And when they lose that as a consequence of their brain injury, or it's significantly diminished, they just simply don't manage and they avoid. Of course, the implications of this are that as time progresses, they become more and more socially isolated. And with that social isolation is the increased risk of conditions such as depression and the various depressive disorders. There's also a higher incidence of the development of anxiety disorders in this patient group, because when they're pushed into a situation where they must socially interact, they often communicate their distress by becoming very anxious, and that reinforces their tendency to try and avoid. So for the management of a person with an avoidant personality disorder, we need to really look at trying to compensate for their impairments and deficits. And that will involve often the utilisation of the traditional cognitive rehab techniques with a cognitive behaviour therapy, particularly focusing on the use of self-talk for that individual, so that they will adopt a mantra or an internalised dialogue, reinforcing with them their capabilities and their skills. It'll also incorporate the use of relaxation strategies and the behavioural management of their anxiety to diminish their avoidance. People with avoidant personality disorders would often benefit from group treatment and being managed in a group setting to enhance their social skills and also to improve their sense of competency about their functional level. Individual supportive psychotherapy is very important for people with avoidant personality disorders because we need to try and improve their sense of worthwhileness and competency by exploring situations and really validating any attempts they have to function and interact within the community. Family members are often involved as well in terms of reinforcing their competencies and trying to emphasise what skills they still have, or when they try and utilise new skills, reinforcing the value of utilising these new skills. The paranoid personality disorder is one that we probably all know. The ability to distinguish between paranoid personality disorder and a paranoid psychosis can be quite difficult, in that the people with a paranoid personality will often be very mistrustful and suspicious of others. But what actually motivates the mistrust and distrustfulness in the situation is often a different thought process. So, for example, the person who is delusional, who has a psychosis, you can't do anything to change their idea, and the manner in which they've come to that idea is often quite bizarre and unusual when you finally explore it. The paranoid personality needs to be in control of their environment, and they're actually quite rigid in their thinking, whereas people with delusional disorders are not necessarily as rigid in terms of their thinking style, and they often don't have the same need to be in control. For the person with a paranoid personality disorder, if they can't be in control, they often become very anxious, but they can also become quite hostile and aggressive. The paranoid personality disorder is clearly a reflection of the change in frontal lobe functioning. In particular here, what I'm referring to is the loss of a flexibility of thinking. They become very black and white rather than grey, and they often have significant problems in terms of utilising strategies because they don't want to be reliant on others. And they find being in a rehabilitation setting extremely challenging for the individual. One of the important things in managing the paranoid personality is in fact that we need to educate the staff that the person has such a disorder. And that leads me back to the earlier comments I made about it almost being mandatory that we do a good assessment of personality as part of our neuropsychometric assessment, because the patients with a paranoid personality disorder are going to react in a very hostile manner to many of the integration and rehabilitation techniques that we utilise, because they see it as being unreasonably critical of their conduct and behaviour, and they often challenge the motives of the therapists. And it's the person with a paranoid personality disorder that is often going to fail to attend or overreact when the therapist is trying to modify or modulate the behaviour. Typically, what has to happen is that we have to manage the environment for these people rather than actually manage the individual, although the use of behavioural management with a feedback to the person about their behaviour and the impact can sometimes be useful and effective. Borderline personality disorders are probably a diagnosis that we're all familiar with. You may not be familiar with its use in the area of traumatic brain injury, and it's really been with the utilisation of the SID that we would use the term borderline personality disorder. But it's actually a great term as far as a description of one of the many behaviour changes that we see following brain injury. The key characteristic of someone with a borderline personality disorder is this instability of their identity, of their emotional control, and of their interpersonal relationships. And they often deal with this instability with impulsive behaviours. So they're the erratic, self-harming, colourful individual that most psychiatrists will be familiar with, and also you'll identify in the traumatic brain injury population as being present as well. That lack of affective stability is in fact one of the key components that many family members identify about traumatic brain injury that they find most difficult to manage. We also know that people with borderline personality disorder are incredibly challenging to manage in psychiatry. And so obviously when someone with a traumatic brain injury has a borderline personality disorder, we actually are increasing the threshold of challenges that we need to deal with. It's probably a combination problem for someone with a traumatic brain injury and a borderline personality disorder, because the affective instability, the problems with regards to impulsive behaviours is a combination of temporal and frontal lobe injury, but also it's difficulties with regards to adjustment and to the adjustment to the injury that ultimately leads to the borderline personality disorder. The management is obviously quite challenging. Many years ago, it was thought that patients with borderline, narcissistic and histrionic personality disorders were refractory to any form of treatment. And almost certainly any form of treatment that we offer people with a borderline personality disorder in general psychiatry is often very time intensive, and the changes that one can see are in fact very small often. But we do know that certain psychotherapeutic techniques can be of value, can reduce the amount of distress in the individual. So if we apply those principles to people with a borderline personality disorder and traumatic brain injury, we can use interventions to improve their management and to contain some of the behaviour. Obviously, the very traditional cognitive strategies, looking at, you know, giving them techniques to improve their memory functioning, is quite important. But in the management of someone with a borderline personality disorder, you really need a structured program where every individual is going to provide feedback about the brain-injured person's individual responsibility for their behaviour and that the impact that their behaviour has on others. So it's a constant reinforcing of, well, you need to be responsible for that. What can you do to improve your control on that? And when you do that, this is what seems to happen. How can you change it? And every therapist needs to adopt the same model. Now, one of the things that happens often with borderline personality disorder patients is this concept of splitting, that one therapist will feel sorry for them in a sense or take their side inadvertently against other therapists, and it's very important to manage that. So if you have a person who has quite a severe borderline personality disorder in a traumatic brain injury setting, you're going to need to do a lot of communication. It's this group of patients that is also going to cause a lot of challenges between the interface of mental health and traumatic brain injury, because often patients with personality disorders are difficult to manage in mental health settings. They're very time consuming and they tend to cause a lot of fragmentation within the system. And you can imagine, obviously, if someone has a brain injury as well as a borderline personality disorder, that that's actually really going to increase the complexity of management, and that there may be a tendency for mental health services to want to have less to do with that individual because they're hard to manage at the best of times, but add the traumatic brain injury and maybe someone else can be responsible for their management. What needs to happen in the management of a person with a borderline personality disorder is really good communication, and often it involves joint meetings. So mental health service are going to have contact with people like this because they self-harm. And they need to have a protocol of how the person is going to be managed. And the TBI services need to have the same protocol. So communication between teams as well as within team is going to be a very important component of managing what are really difficult patients. The other thing that happens with someone who has a borderline personality disorder is that they often don't have a very good boundary between themselves and their environment. And that also means that they often don't have a good boundary between their own identity and maybe that of the therapist. Now, in rehabilitation settings, this absence of boundaries can actually cause quite substantial challenges, because it's in rehabilitation settings that, for example, the therapist might go to the patient's home, that they will go out into the community with them for their reintegration. If they have a problem of identifying and establishing boundaries, they may start to lose that concept that the therapist is in fact a therapist and start to think of them as a friend. And then, of course, when the friend lets them down, they're not there on a weekend because the therapist doesn't work on a weekend, they react in a very angry and hostile manner. So for patients with the borderline personality disorder following brain injury, we need to be really careful about the boundaries. We need to sometimes re-examine in what settings we're going to offer them rehabilitation, and always be very clear about the boundary between therapist and friend. The real challenge for these patients often is when they have attendant care, because often our attendant carers do not have the same level of training or education to be able to be aware of what it means to have a borderline personality disorder and how they can have this problem between boundaries. So we need to also incorporate our attendant carers in our management programs for such patients. In summary then, I think it's important for us to know that there is not going to be any one type of personality or types of personality seen following brain injury. Ultimately, the personality that we see in a person who's had a brain injury is a very complex interaction between that person's premorbid traits, their premorbid coping styles, and their experiences in their childhood and development. And that this past history, so to speak, or the baggage that they come to the brain injury with, is going to be modified by various neuropsychological and neuroanatomical deficits. So, for example, you know, damage to the frontal and limbic area, and it's that interaction which ultimately produces our personality. Each individual who has a traumatic brain injury will obviously have a very individual personality. And the diagnostic systems that I've spoken about and alluded to in the presentation may not always do merit or be of value in describing that individual person that you're working with. We do know that there is a very high incidence of abnormalities of personality after brain injury. What we now need to do is focus on providing an appropriate therapeutic environment for those individuals so that we can try and reduce the amount of distress, because ultimately it's the disturbances of behaviour and personality that cause the greatest amount of burden to both the individual and their community, and in particular their carers.